All right, good afternoon, everybody. I assume it's afternoon wherever you all are, given I expect most people are in the United States right now. I am now just trying to make sure that I have controls for the slideshow. So give me one second. Looks like it. All right, so I'm having some interesting technological we'll say glitches at the moment, but I should be able to do this fine with everybody here. So I'm going to go ahead and get started just as long as I can see my slides. If I need to, I may ask Pete or Jody to pull slides for me, but at the moment, I
Certainly.
think I'm good. So as you mentioned, my name is Taylor Jones, and I have you for the next 2 hours. So here we go. Our course objectives today are to understand how people evaluate presentations, and there's a lot there to discuss, to review best practices for presentations, and to develop a game plan for presentations. So you should all be able to walk away from this knowing a little bit more about what the considerations are when you're developing a presentation, and also walk away with this with a game plan for your own presentations moving forward. Let's see if this works. Okay, so the agenda is I'm going to give you a quick introduction, then an overview of the research on presentations and how people react to them, how people can, better make presentations, then an overview of presentation skills, and finally we'll put it all together. For each of these, what I would like is for participation. So if you have questions, don't hesitate to ask them. I believe the format will be you typing the question, though, and I will follow up at each section. I will ask what questions there were and address those, and then also leave questions for the end. I also want to do just a little bit of housekeeping right now. So I'm on the East Coast. I have you from 1 to 3 my time. I will always, in any presentation, get people out on time or early. So I'm going to leave the last 10 or 15 minutes for questions and answers, but I will get you out of here by 3 p.m. Eastern. And whatever the end is for your time. So we're moving on to the introduction. So you may be wondering who I am and why you're listening to me talk to you about presentations for 2 hours. And that's a very good question. It's a relevant question. So I'm a facilitator with actually more than a decade of experience teaching difficult topics around diversity and inclusion. And what that means is that I have a lot of practice in large rooms of people where we're talking about contentious issues, which is going to be similar in some respects to the difficulty that you may all face with your presentations, and of course different in other respects because we're often talking about, race and gender and hot buttons sort of triggering issues for people that engender a lot of emotion. So I have a decade plus of that under my belt, with nothing but positive responses so far. No, never crashed and burned. But then I'm also a quantitative social scientist, specifically finishing up a PhD in linguistics, with teaching experience across a variety of classes, including statistics, including discussion of my research in linguistics, and a variety of conference talks, invited lectures, and academic talks for the general public. In the time since I made these slides, I would also add that my research has been picked up by a lot of news outlets, and so I can now add to this experience with radio interviews, journalists, all of that stuff. So my entire job for the past decade plus has been public speaking and communicating research or communicating difficult topics to the general public. And lastly, it may not seem relevant at first, but I started as a performer with a background playing music professionally. And that, I think, is actually still very relevant because you learn how to read a room and you learn how to adjust what you're doing on the fly, especially if you're playing jazz, as I was. So all of these things fit together to create a background where I have, extensive familiarity with talking to groups of people, anywhere from 5 people, which I think I'll be doing something 5 or 6 people tomorrow, to 300 people, talking to the Navy JAG Corps, to talking to foreign audiences, and everything in between. And I have a little bit that I've learned in the last little while doing that. So the point here is that my career consists of communicating scientific ideas to the general public through presentations and relying on the platform skills, which we'll discuss shortly. And you'll notice as I go through this presentation, I am making use of most of these. Since I'm in an empty conference room, imagining an audience of 200 people, there's a few tweaks. So, you know, I can't tell you about the body language stuff right now, but you'll have to imagine that I'm following what I'm going to tell you shortly. All right. That's who I am. I assume there aren't any questions there, but I will stop and ask what questions you have just in case before we go forward. There's any particularly good questions.
So we don't have any questions in the Connect Room queue, and if anybody on the phone happens to have a question, you can hit #6 to unmute yourself. Otherwise, I think we'll go ahead and continue with the presentation.
Excellent. I didn't expect any questions, but you never know. So with that, I'd like to dive into an overview of the research on presentations. And it sometimes surprises people to know that there is a fairly large body of research on presentations and presentation skills. Often we're just thrown into doing presentations, and you either learn as you do it or you learn from failures. And that's one way of doing things. I think everybody's familiar with that. But at the same time, there is a wealth of material on what makes a presentation believable, what makes a presentation engaging, and you know what really lends to audiences understanding what it is you have to say, and then also believing you, which is an important part, especially for a lot of the different components of the EPA, where you're giving presentations to the general public and may experience some sort of pushback. So what I will say is I'm going to start with why bother. And the reason is that there's a wealth of research that indicates platform skills affect perceived credibility. So what that means is that your ability to talk extemporaneously about your research, about your findings, about whatever it is you need to communicate to the general public on behalf of your organization, your ability to do that directly affects whether or not people believe what it is you're telling them, find it credible, or choose to follow up with your recommendations. For all of you, you're public-facing, and you have an important message. It's important that it's communicated effectively. So this is not the same as the academic linguistics conference that I just came from, where it's a bunch of academics in a room who are talking about very obscure ideas about syntax. Your job is very, very important, and it's very important to the general public. And so these are important skills to have. And the important point here at the end is that platform skills are skills. They're not inherent. It's not that you either can do it or you can't. You can learn, practice, and improve. It's not you have it or you don't. Let's see. So the research tells us a lot about what lends to people's credibility, what creates believability, and what allows for effective communication of your message. And the first part is that we can tell when people believe what they're saying and when they're confident in it, to a certain extent. So what that means is that there's a variety of cues that lead people to lend more credence to what you're saying. There's verbal and nonverbal cues. So I'm going to give you a quick overview. You can Google these if you want to later, and there's a ton of other citations. But these are just, I just wanted to have the citations here in case anybody has questions about it. You can follow up on your own. Verbal versus nonverbal, the key takeaway of this Tenney et al. Study from 2019 was that people can tell when there's not a sync between what you're saying and how you're saying it nonverbally. So your nonverbal communication, that would be your stance, that would be your posture, that would be your gestures, that would be your facial expressions. If those don't line up with what you're actually saying, people will remember the nonverbal, and it will inform how they interpret the message. So if you have a script and you're very confident in your script, but your physicality betrays that you're not confident in what you're saying, people notice this. And it's something that I'm sure you've all experienced this at some point, where you see somebody who's saying one thing, but their body language is telling you another. Similarly, Jiang and Pell find in 2017 that we can tell confidence in part from the voice. And so there's a lot of, you're going to hear a lot of linguistic stuff from me because I'm an academic linguist and I find that stuff the most interesting. But one of these things, they look at the phonetic character of the voice. And there's all of these different features that phoneticians look at. So jitter, shimmer, but all of this boils down to we can tell if you're, you know, out of breath, if you're nervous, and whether or not you're confident in what you're saying, not just based on whether you're saying something confident, but how you're saying it again. And then lastly, there's evidence that professionals lower vocal frequency when giving expert advice. And this was a particularly fun study because they got experts in their fields. They had them wait in a room to do an interview to talk about their own research. But they also sent in a researcher compatriot who came and asked where the bathroom is in this building that the researchers were not, you know, from. This wasn't their normal workspace. And when they were asked questions that they didn't know the answer to or they were unsure about, they had a much higher vocal pitch, much higher vocal frequency than when they were giving expert advice. And this should ring true to everybody because if you ask me, you know, where's the bathroom? I'm currently talking to you from the ICF building in Fairfax County, and if you ask me where the bathroom is right now, I absolutely would say to you, well, I think it's around the corner there or whatever. You ask me about linguistics or you listen to the rest of the talk, this is the voice that I'm going to be talking to you in. So this is not to tell you all that it's hopeless and that, you know, your body and your voice and your uncertainty will give itself away as you're giving a presentation. But it is to say that there's some thought that should be given to lining up how you present.
Are you?
And what goes with you. And for those of you there talking about whether you're supposed to wear it every day, you may want to mute your microphone for the moment. All right, so the point of that, all of that, like I said, is just to say that there needs to be a sync between what you're saying and how you're saying it, and people notice when there's not. This does not mean that you actually have to be super confident. You can fake it till you make it, so to speak. But the point is that there needs to be some thought given to these presentation skills because it will affect what people remember about your talk and how they remember the content. So the good news is that the clues to confidence are measurable. That's pitch, intonation, and speed. They influence perceptions of speaker confidence. Pitch is literally the pitch of your voice, so what note you're sitting on. And you should be speaking in a comfortable range for your voice rather than, you know, way too low or way too high. I don't know if anybody saw the documentary about I believe it was called The Inventor, documentary about the woman who founded Theranos. But there's a lot of discussion in that about artificially, you know, dropping her voice too low and people noticing that. Versus the same thing, if I speak way up here, you're going to notice that there's something a little bit weird, especially if you're looking at me, about what you're hearing. So pitch, intonation, that would be, you know, declaring things that you intend to declare rather than asking them as questions. And speed. My main problem in giving presentations is that I start to speak faster and faster and faster because my natural speaking speed is very fast. I live in Manhattan. Everybody around me talks fast, moves fast. Everything's fast. And I have to constantly remind myself to slow down and to enunciate when giving this kind of presentation. And I think for a lot of you who have the issue of speaking too quickly, which is many of us, you may find that it's important in giving presentations to slow down and to take your time. So I was always taught by some of my mentors around this to think of Maya Angelou. And I think that's actually a great cue for people. So if any of you have ever seen Maya Angelou give an interview, she savors every word that she's saying. And it becomes, one, much easier to follow what she's saying. But two, you realize that what she's saying has some weight to it. She could say anything, it'll sound like it'll have weight to it. And then the second part here is that we're more likely to believe and cooperate with people who send signals of confidence. The interesting thing is that it's even when we think it was about the presentation and not about presentation skills. So there was a great study, it's Clark 2008, where they asked people about presentations after the fact, and they modulated all these cues of confidence and speaker confidence, and the content was the same. But the speakers who exhibited more cues for confidence in speaking and their posture and all that were considered to be more believable speakers, even though they delivered the exact same script. People said that, oh, the content was better in this one versus the other one. So, you know, people remember the presentation skills, whether or not they're aware that that's what they're actually evaluating it based on. And we can talk all day about whether that should be the case and whether that's fair to us and if we should really be focusing on the content. But at the end of the day, this is something that affects how people understand the material. They walk away and they think, okay, that was a really good presentation, and I, you know, believe what they said. But the content could be exactly the same either way. So these are important skills. Now, the last part that I think is crucial, because I've given you what for some of us may come across as bad news. If you aren't already super confident in your presentations, you may be thinking, oh, this is bad. But the good news is not only can we measure this, we can improve it with training. And that's backed up in the research as well. So communication training can improve presentation skills. And then you have all of those benefits of, you know, believability and positive evaluations and all of that stuff that goes with, you know, a good presentation. So let's see. The takeaway here is that presentation skills matter. They have an effect on whether people believe what you're saying. And presentation skills and confidence affect believability, audience confidence. The better your presentation skills are, the better your presentations are going to go. The key here is that we can improve those communication skills with training and practice. And you all have an important message, so it's important that you do, you know, improve your communication skills. That's not to say that some of you aren't already excellent communicators, but as you know, we can always improve. And given the importance of your message, I think it's important that we actually have this talk today. So what I'm going to do is then get into the overview of presentation skills, but I do want to pause here for any questions that may have arisen while I was talking about the research.
And so we don't have anything in the queue right now. If anybody does have any questions, please feel free to go ahead and type them up and submit them, and we'll wait another few seconds or so to see if anything comes in. Otherwise, we can proceed.
Excellent. One of the things you'll notice as I'm talking about these presentation skills as I continue is that I am going to be using all of these features as we go through. So you'll see I'm going to talk about pausing to ask questions later on as well. So I don't see any questions. I don't hear anything from Pete, so I'm going to continue with an overview of the presentation skills. So I have this divided into four main domains of presentation competencies. And you could divide this into seven. You could divide these into two. I have four because I think this is the way that these things sort of best fit together. But you'll notice that these are all interlocking pieces. So I'm going to discuss these in order as each section. One is content management. Then visual aids, that's your PowerPoints, your presentations, your, you know, flow charts, whatever it is you're using. The third is the platform skills, how you actually communicate that information along with the content and the visual aids. And the last is participant management, which, depending on who I'm talking to, some audiences really want to talk about participant management, some don't. So I'll see, you know, where you all are on participant management. I know the NARPM folks were very serious about participant management because they had to communicate all kinds of bad news to the general public, and people got angry. So they wanted to know, you know, how do I handle this? And I'll have skills and tools for you there as well. All right, so first up, content management. Effective speakers are going to do each of these four things. You connect the subject matter with objectives. So that means you know what the objectives are going into your presentation, what it is you need to communicate, and what you want to get out of the presentation. You'll notice the first thing that I did in these slides is I said these are the objectives of what we're going to discuss today. And at the end, I'll talk about the objectives and how we went through and actually met them. Second, you'll analyze participants' needs, their current level of expertise, and their expectations. So different groups may have very different needs. Just as I mentioned, the NARPM folks have, you know, a need for talking about participant management. It's really useful to think about who your audience is and what you want them to get out of the presentation beyond just the information that you need to communicate, but also, you know, what are they here for? What are their needs? And they'll tell you that, especially in a situation where you can actually see and hear them. You'll be able to get feedback both non-verbally from them, and then also as you take breaks, people will come up and ask, and you can sort of modulate your presentation depending on the timeline for a presentation. So some of you are giving 20-minute talks, and I do everything from a 20-minute talk to a 6-hour, 8-hour full day. So you'll modulate that. The third is to identify and organize key points that support the objectives and meet the participants' needs. So this is synthesizing the previous two. You know what the subject matter is, you know what the objectives are, you know what the participants' needs are and have evaluated their current level of expertise and their expectations, and then you have to synthesize that so you can say what are the key points that meet those objectives, that meet the participant needs, and then you can jettison all of the extra stuff that you may want to say but that doesn't necessarily get you where you're going. And the last one, and the one that we often don't necessarily all do well, is identifying potential problem areas and strategies. I think a lot of times if we have a presentation and we're up the night before, you know, eyes wide open, staring at the ceiling, stressed out about our talk the next day, we're, you know, worrying, maybe catastrophizing, but that doesn't necessarily count as actually identifying problem areas and coming up with strategies. You know, it's not, a lot of times we have very unrealistic expectations of what the worst case scenario may be. And then the actual problem areas may be different. So, for instance, today, for me giving this talk to you, a potential problem area was the weather. There's a storm moving in through D.C. It's shutting down, you know, businesses, offices. People are, you know, some people are evacuating. I don't know where everybody is in the country, but if you have familiarity with Washington, D.C. and snow, it's very dramatic here when it snows. So that's one thing that could potentially affect things. Another is technology, which I'll talk about later, and making sure that you have strategies for these sort of realistic problems rather than, you know, staying awake at night and panicking. And the other thing is these will alleviate those other worries when you know, okay, I have a checklist, I have problem areas, and I have strategies for dealing with them. Then you have much less to worry about because you have something concrete. Now, I'll say I'm talking a lot about worry here. I'm assuming that people are nervous about presentations. You may all not be. I did just get back from a linguistics conference, as I mentioned, and linguists are notoriously introverted. So I'm sort of still thinking in that framework. Anyway, moving on to content management. The first question you want to ask yourself is, what is the key point of your talk? What do you want people to understand from what you're saying? What is the takeaway? If you're on Twitter, think about what is the tweet that you want people to remember? What is the, you know, elevator pitch? What is the 280-character short sentence of this is what I got from that talk? From there, you can start to strategize about what do people need to know to understand that point. And I think this is crucial because it's very easy to dump in all the relevant information, to want to say these are all of the facts, this is all of the research, this is everything that's related, because, you know, we're often in the weeds as far as our own research goes. But the real question is, what is the point, the key takeaway, and what supports my moving towards that point, and how do I then organize that? The last part that's hugely important is the question of where can people go astray? And this is something that often is surprising. So I, you know, once gave a talk I've been doing a lot of research on computational linguistics, and so I'm doing a lot of like linear algebra and matrix manipulation and all of this, you know, very sciencey stuff. And I gave a talk on those findings to sociolinguists who don't generally do computational stuff. I talked for 20 minutes, and my first question in the Q&A session was, what is a matrix? So thankfully, you know, most of the audience was with me. But this was something that I hadn't anticipated in that talk, the question of where can people go astray and what kind of guidance do people need to understand all of the foundations of what it is you're going to say. The other point here is that when you think about where people can go astray, the other way of looking at that is you can set up all of the information in your talk that's relevant to make the point that you want to make, But you should think about, how can people misinterpret that argument? How can people go down sort of a garden path and find themselves coming to a weird conclusion based on the information that they were given? And then you can address that in your talk strategically as you give a presentation. All right. So for content management, I want to talk about basic organization. I have, five key points here. So you'll introduce the topic. In this case, today, our topic is presentation skills, effective presentations, stand and deliver. Provide a motivation, which I did by talking to you about what the research says about why presentation skills are important. Describe the necessary context, which can vary for some of you. So, you're talking about, on-site issues. Oftentimes the context may seem clear to people, but you want to make sure that people have all the background that they need to really understand and not assume that they have the necessary context to understand where you're going. And then you'll explain the research question or point you want to make and lay out the data and analysis and strategy for how you're going to work your way through the material so that people understand the point that you get to. And everything here, I think it's really important to hammer home. You should be thinking about what is the key takeaway, and everything is in support of that. So not what is all the information that I have, and how can I fit everything into the slides, but what is the key takeaway, and how can I guide people along that path? And a lot of times it's easy for us to assume that people will follow, but it really helps to have this kind of signposting. You start with an introduction, you start with a motivation, why somebody should care, describe the necessary context. And all of this goes for presentations as well as memos and papers and everything else. This is a very useful format for organizing your materials. I'm pausing for a moment when I speak because I have to double check that my slides are actually progressing. I see them, but just a little bit slower than the rest of you, I think. So continuing, you want to talk about documentation of your findings. You can do that point by point, or you can just lay out the necessary pieces to make your argument. You can have a synthesis of those two as well, where you have, these are all the points, but I'm jumping from this one to this one to this one, so you can all follow. And then you provide comments to explain findings or implications of the argument. That's a conclusion where you explain and reiterate the point of what you did. You say, I was going to do this, here's why, here's what we're going to do, you do it. And then afterwards you say, I did this, I demonstrated things in these ways. And then finally wrap up, that's the question period, that's, your final end of the presentation where you say your thanks and your question and answer and all of that other fun stuff. Are there any questions about content management before I move forward to talking about visual aids?
Unless anybody has any questions on the phone lines, we do not have any queued up in the Connect room.
Okay. I always like participation, and it's a little strange for me in a room where I know that you're out there, but I can't see you and I can't hear you. So if you have any questions, if you have any comments, please don't hesitate to send them in, and I will continue to pause for them. I'm assuming, a lot of you may be with a cup of tea by a window, looking out at the snow out here, or at the clouds in Seattle, or wherever you are. Don't forget to send in some questions if you have them. That said, I'm going to move on to visual aids, and we'll talk about organization. Now, my focus is primarily here on PowerPoint slides because that's the vast majority of what people do. However, these will also go for posters. These will also go for flip charts and whatever you may be using. So, effective speakers prepare visuals that are legible or readable, clearly related to the content being presented, organized, and consistently formatted. Now, this can vary depending on your field, and this can vary depending on what your presentation is on and who it's for. So, you have a lot of leeway here. This can cover anything from flow charts to mind maps to, handwritten flip charts. But the idea is that you want it to be consistent across all of these things, legible and readable, even if you're writing it by hand, clearly related to the content being presented. I'll tell you a story. There was a presentation that I was at about, I think it was 4 years ago now, and the person presenting really loved cats and loved, you know, internet cat memes. And they thought it would be fun to give a talk on, I believe this was something along the lines of, like, you know, the phonology of truncation in a Papuan, you know, language. But every slide had cat memes on it. And while I will tell you that everyone I know who was there still vividly remembers that presentation, it's for entirely the wrong reasons. The material on the slides was not at all related to the content. And, I mean, it was tangentially related to the content. It was sort of, you know, the appropriate meme for, or image macro for what this presenter was talking about at the time. But I could not tell you right now what the actual point of the presentation was. What I can tell you is we all remember thinking, oh my God, this is another cat slide. And why did this person choose to do this for a serious topic? So you want it to be related to the content being presented. That's not to say that you can't, you know, theoretically find a place where, you know, internet memes of cats maybe can fit. But the idea is, you know, if you're using something like that, if you're using humor, to use it very sparingly. And for your slides to be, or your visuals to be, something that is in support of the message that you are delivering. Now, this does not mean that it should be the same message that you were delivering just written. So one of the things that a lot of people do is they'll prepare a speech, and then they will put that speech on slides, and they'll just stand in front of you and read it and call it a day. That is a terrible presentation. One of the things that I'm actually very partial to is having images, but images that are related. So, you know, a map, a visual, something that's a visual cue for the audience to hang what you're saying off of. And it actually helps them remember different parts of the discussion later, because the visual sort of jogs that memory. There's a lot to be said about how people, how memory works and how people remember what you're saying. But having a simple visual that's directly related to what you're saying can really significantly add to a presentation. Having something that's completely unrelated can also, on the other side of the coin, very significantly detract. Lastly, it should be organized and consistently formatted. So what that means is, for instance, as you're looking at the slides that I'm using today, there's a specific template for these slides, and they are formatted consistently across the board, with the exception of the visuals of bad slides that we're going to get to shortly. So each of these follows the EPA formatting. You may like it, you may hate it, but it's a very nice that your organization has a specific template to use, and it's a consistent template, and so everything across the board is the same font, it's the same size, it's the same kind of bullet points, it's the same color scheme. That kind of thing makes a huge difference in presentations. And so if you're looking at a presentation where it's alternating between Times New Roman and Cambria and Comic Sans and Papyrus and 10-point font and 18-point font, that becomes, again, so distracting that it becomes the focus of the presentation rather than the content that's actually being presented. You want all of your formatting to be in service of your talking rather than becoming the focus of the presentation. It should be background unless it's drawn to your attention like I just did here. Now, this is hugely important. Effective speakers manage the visual aids by testing equipment and having contingency plans. And then we'll talk about the body as well, but the first part, this testing equipment and having contingency plans, this is huge. And a lot of people find that they're tripped up by not having a contingency plan and not testing the equipment beforehand. I would not be talking to you right now for this webinar if I had not shown up early and had a contingency plan and tested equipment. So the original room that I was in had a phone that by all appearances looked to be working, but was not. And these are the kind of things that, you know, it's easy to forget about, but one of the things that I always recommend is just build in extra time. So anytime I'm giving a talk, if I talk at 7 a.m. for, you know, the Navy, for instance, I'll be there at 6, even if I don't like it. I'll be there at 6 and ready to test the equipment and find a contingency plan. And I can't tell you how many times that has saved a presentation for me, because I show up and we find out that there's a problem and I find out with 45 minutes or a half hour to solve the problem rather than 15 minutes or 10 minutes or 5 to solve the problem that we didn't know was going to occur. So that's hugely, hugely important. The second part is positioning the body to avoid blocking participants' view. This is going to depend on where you are, so I'm lucky today to not have to worry about that at all. But in general, there's two different ways that people kind of go astray with their, you know, physicality in the room. One is blocking the view, standing directly in front of the screen, standing in front of the projector, standing and turning and facing your slides rather than talking to the audience, but somehow blocking the view of your visuals. And then the other is the opposite of that. It's people trying to hide. So you kind of get behind the lectern if it's there, or you walk off to the corner of the room and try and make yourself a little bit smaller. These are things that we often can naturally do without realizing that we're doing it, and you find yourself just shrinking behind a lectern and behind the microphone until, you know, you're just barely peering over the top of it. So often what I'll do if there is a lectern and a microphone, if I can, I'll stand next to the lectern. It gives me a place where I'm out of the way, but I'm also not able to hide behind it because I'm standing next to it and I'm facing everybody. Lastly is speaking to participants rather than to the visual. There's a lot of different key points for talking about speaking to participants, but the main idea is you should not be turning your back on the audience to talk to your slides. It can be reassuring because you see what your slides are and you're reminded what you're going to say, and also you don't have to look out at all these faces staring at you or, you know, nodding off or whatever's happening. But it tanks a presentation. And a brief aside on nodding off, because I think this is hugely important. I have been giving talk after talk after talk after talk for years and years and years and years. And what I will tell you is in any group larger than 20 people, somebody is going to look like they're going to sleep. It doesn't matter how exciting the presentation is. It doesn't matter how contentious an argument is that's happening in the room. Somebody's going to look like they're dozing off. And you should remember this and remember that it is not a reflection on you or on your presentation. And often, surprisingly, the people who you think maybe aren't paying attention will come up to you after the talk and say, that was fantastic. And they'll talk about specific points that you mentioned and ask you, you know, very focused questions. So, you know, sometimes we may give a little too much credence to other people's body language as we're looking at the audience. And start getting worried, oh my God, I'm losing them, because there's one person in the audience who's not, you know, nodding along. And I'll say, you know, don't worry about that. Now, if everybody's nodding off, you may have a problem. But, you know, if you have one person, that is normal. So let me go back just a little bit. Here we go. Okay. What I want to do is talk about what makes a slide bad. So this is where you talk to me. I want to ask you, what are your thoughts about what makes a slide bad? And then I'm going to give you examples of two bad slides, and we'll talk about what makes them specifically bad. So start submitting your questions or asking your questions or I guess your suggestions of what makes a slide bad. All right, I see. Too many words, too much text. Font size, yes, absolutely. Too much data to read effectively. Yeah, so I'm noticing a pattern here in these responses, which sounds like a lot of you have seen the same kind of bad slides a few times. So that would be, you know, font size, busy graphics, too much writing, small text, labels that aren't legible. And a new one that I don't always see, which is excessive animations. I'm assuming that's the transition animations between slides that PowerPoint so helpfully provides to us and gives us way too many options for. So I can imagine overuse of transitions beginning to get distracting. Reading what you're trying to say, excellent. Too much text, poorly formatted figures, bad symbology, all good stuff. All right, so all of that said, I'm going to show you two bad slides, and we're going to talk about what makes these specific slides bad. So number one is the How Rivers Are Formed. And just a meta note here, you'll notice that I have put a bad slide inside of a good slide template. So I still have my header, that's still my consistent formatting for this presentation, and then an image on the inside of a terrible slide. So what is wrong with this? Busy background and poor contrast is exactly correct. Can't read over the picture. So this is a white serif font. I think this is a Times New Roman font in white over yellows, light greens, whites, and blues. It is very, very difficult to read the font. Even just black on here would work, but if you think about, you know, complementary colors in the color wheel, you're going to see something else that would work much better over this. Dense text, can't easily read. I see too much information, too many words, unrelated picture. The picture, for instance, it's a picture of a river, right? We're talking about how rivers are formed, so it's somewhat sort of thematically related. But yeah, it's way too much going on. This is effectively an entire section of a presentation written out in paragraph form. And I'll tell you, I was actually at a presidential address for the Linguistic Society of America 2 days ago, and a historical linguist gave a talk, and it was this. It was not how rivers are formed, but it was this kind of slide, but it was the entire speech, the hour-long speech, written out in paragraphs on his slides, and that was the slide. That was the presentation. And it was on ancient Greek. All right, so poor contrast, no spaces between bullets. Yes, all of this is accurate. So here's a question for you all. How would you make this better? How would you reformat this? I have refreshed and I see zero answers. There we go. Fewer words. Offset the text from picture. Exactly. So one of the things that you can do is have a split slide where you have a picture on one side, if you need a picture, and you have your text on the other. Series of figures would be better. I see put only three bullets per page. The formatting for this particular slideshow, like the one that I'm giving you right now, is no more than six bullets, I believe, and they should not be paragraphs like this. Yeah, more relevant picture, get rid of it or move it. These are all excellent responses. And I would say also, you know, for these bullet points, you don't need rivers start as very small streams and gradually get bigger as more and more water is added, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you can have rivers start as streams and then elaborate on that verbally. So one of the things that I strongly recommend to people is your slides should be little mnemonic cues for you to hang your discussion off of. It should be just enough to tell you what you were going to say and that people understand what you're talking about if they zone out and they look up and they see, ah, yes, that's what's on the slide and that makes sense connected to what they're saying. But you definitely don't need, you know, adjectives and adverbs and all these modifiers and all this stuff and paragraph form. So these are all excellent suggestions. What I'm going to do is move on to the next bad slide, which I believe is from the Pentagon, who are notorious for some of the worst slides in the world. I recommend, if you haven't, Google bad military slides or bad Pentagon slides, and you'll see a ton of these. But this is a slide about, I'm not even sure what it's about. Definitely warfare related, but you can tell me what is wrong with this slide. I just refreshed the comments and I see, ugh. It is like a maze. It is absolutely unreadable. I have blown this up actually quite large before, and it's still surprisingly unreadable. So the font size is small, but making it bigger doesn't necessarily help. See, small font, no real objective. Exactly. It's not clear what the goal of this slide is. It's not clear what the direction is. What I get from this is everything is directly related to everything else. Nothing is more important than anything else. And everything feeds into everything else. And it's not clear what all of those things are. So, you know, I'm looking at this with tribal governance and central government and popular support, and it's not clear how those things relate to each other or why. It is absolutely, as some of you have said, overwhelming, too busy. So I'm not going to ask you how you would fix this slide because I think that would be cruel. But this is an idea of an extreme example of what not to do. And hopefully the rest of my slides here are a positive example of, just a baseline of what to do. So you'll notice the rest of our slides as we talk, it's anywhere from one to a maximum of six bullet points. Maybe some sub-bullet points, but only one sub-level, not two or three or four. And it's consistently formatted, and it's in service of what I'm saying. I don't know that I necessarily have any other images in these slides. We'll find out together. The images that I have used are these images of bad slides, which are directly relevant to what we're talking about. So it should be a useful contrast here if you think about even what you're looking at right now. Now, that said, I'd like to segue into the next part here, which is other technology. And this is something that's extremely important and often overlooked as well. So arrive early and find your point of contact for tech, if any. Again, that saved me today. And actually, on Friday, I gave two separate talks on linguistic research and saved me there, and has saved me more times than I can count, as I go to different places and facilitate and talk. Also, when you arrive early, it may take you a moment to find your point of contact for technology. It may be that they don't have exactly what you expected, so you have to, leave yourself time so that you can strategize and figure out a way to adapt and overcome. Test the microphone setup as well, if it's present. And this is crucial. If it is present, use it. There's a lot of us who have a variety of reasons why we don't like using microphones, and I completely understand the feeling, but what I will say is if the microphone is present, use it. Just make this as a professional decision. This is just what I do. It's like wearing a tie. If you are in a situation where you have to wear a tie, you might not like wearing a tie, but you wear a tie, and then you take it off when you're done. And I'm saying that now as I realize I'm in an empty room, I am loosening my tie. because I realize you can all imagine that I haven't. So the key with the microphone is that you don't necessarily know what people's disabilities are. You don't necessarily know that everybody can hear you. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen other presenters say, "I'll just talk loud." Or they'll ask, "Can everybody in the back hear me?" Well, if they can't hear you, they're not going to answer that question, first of all. Second of all, like I said, you don't know what people's disabilities are. I do a lot of work with the Navy, and there's people who have targeted disabilities. They may have hearing loss in one ear or both ears, and may not want to talk about it, may say, I'll figure it out. But you lose people that way, and there's no reason to. And an extreme example of this was a film screening that I was at. It was a project through Gallaudet University and Georgetown University, and it was a film screening about black sign language. So without getting too far into the weeds of linguistics here, sign language is not one language. There are a number of different sign languages. So ASL, or American Sign Language, is one kind of sign language. Because of the history of segregation in this country, there is also black sign language, which differs in some interesting ways. There was a film screening about black sign language. This is a room where you have some unknown but significant number of deaf people in the room. You have some unknown but significant number of people with partial hearing loss. And then you have hearing people and interpreters and whatever else. And I can't tell you how surprising it was to me that no fewer than five people during the Q&A session attempted to refuse the microphone and said, "Oh, I'll just talk loud." So it's something that I think is natural. We hear this a lot. But it's really important to just use the microphone, use the technology. In this case, there were people with auditory implants that were connected to the audio-visual in the room. So if you use the microphone, the people with partial hearing loss can actually hear you. And the people with who have partial hearing loss, if you don't use the microphone, just can't hear you. So you know, that was a lot there, but the key takeaway here is use the microphone. And there's one last thing that I want to say about using a microphone, which is that for a lot of us, one of the things I hear over and over and over again is, well, I don't like the sound of my own voice. And that is completely normal. That is completely natural. There's actually a very good reason for that, which is that as we are speaking, normally when we hear our own voices as we're speaking, we're also hearing the vibration in our own skull. So your brain kind of filters that out, but as you speak, your vocal cords move, your throat creates noise, your mouth creates noise, and your skull actually resonates with your speech, and your brain filters that out. When you are hearing yourself played back, either a recording of yourself or you hear yourself through speakers in the audiovisual because you're using the microphone, it can be a little disconcerting because it doesn't sound the way that we think we sound. What I will say is just keep in mind that there's a physiological reason for that. And if you don't like the sound of your own voice for other reasons, you know, that's your own personal business. But I think it's much more important, especially given the importance of the messages that you all have to communicate, it's more important to communicate effectively and manage that discomfort than to, you know, potentially lose people in the audience because they just can't hear you. And, you know, if you have a large audience, you don't even have to worry about hearing loss or you know, deafness in the audience or anything else like that. It can be hard to project across a large room. So I know I got a little carried away here. I've said a lot about this, but if there's a microphone, use the microphone. And what that means is test it out. So if it's there, don't say, well, it didn't work, so, you know, I guess I won't use it. Use the microphone. So I have to say, I had to refresh my slide, and I saw the responses to the bad slides before. I looked down and saw somebody say, what is the point of all of this? And thought, that was cold-blooded right now, before I realized I was back about the previous slide. So I just had a momentary scare. I go, rude. Anyway, moving on with the other technology. Let's see what I have here. So that is the key takeaway I have. What I'll say, too, is with the other technology, if you have your own computer to provide or if they're providing the computer for you, you always want to test that kind of setup. So, for instance, I do a lot of work with the military. I cannot bring my own computer on base. Well, technically, I can bring my computer on base, but I can't get it off base. It then will, you know, potentially be seized. So I also can't bring thumb drives or anything else like that. So you get used to really working the point of contact for technology so you know that your slides are loaded or you have a CD or you have whatever it is that's necessary to get your visuals and get your slides together for your talk. Similarly, giving conference talks, you know, they'll often say, well, just plug in your computer. You want to make sure that you actually have what you need to plug in your computer. So if it's an HDMI but you need a Thunderbolt connection, that's the kind of thing that you should be aware of beforehand and prep for, either with your own or you can ask your point of contact, you know, can you provide these things? And you figure it out from there. But that kind of audio-visual preparation is something that we often don't think about because we're so caught up in the material that we're going to present. And then you get there, and if you don't have this as just a routine checklist that you know you always do, it can be a bad situation that catches you by surprise. So that's what I'll say. Are there any questions on technology or the visuals before I move on to talking about the basics of presentation skills as you're speaking in the room? Let me rephrase that. What are your questions about those? And Pete, if you can tell me what you're seeing, if you're seeing anything, that would be helpful. All right, in that case, I'm going to continue on to talk about the basics of platform skills. And this is where we get into the real meat of presentation. All right, so I have here the maximum number of bullet points on my slide. Talking about prior presentation, posture and movement, breathing, speed and pacing, asking questions, and answering questions. And I'm going to get into these one by one as we move forward. So first is the prior preparation. The question you want to ask is there a preferred format? In this case, for me, there is a preferred format, so I'm following that format. And then you want to know, what is your time frame for providing secondary materials? That's your slides, that's your poster, that's whatever it is that's going to support your talk. These are things that you want done in advance, but you also are going to have to manage other people as you do these things. So you want to make sure that you leave plenty of time to manage getting those secondary materials to people and making sure that they're in the appropriate format. The other ideas about prior preparation are, you'll want to decide if you want or need a script. Some people feel much more comfortable if they've written out a script for themselves. They know exactly what they're going to say and when they're going to say it. Others prefer not to. So I'm one of the people who, I know exactly what the points are that I'm going to make. My slides tell me what the points are I'm going to make, whether they say them explicitly or not. And I prefer not to use a script because I find the thought of writing a script exhausting. However, some of my colleagues at CulturePoint are the exact opposite. They write a very specific, meticulous, detailed script for themselves that they prepare. They'll run through it. They'll deliver it a few times. One of them will use flashcards or, you know, something in their hands to work through the script while still looking at the audience that they're talking. And another writes a script, tweaks the script, memorizes the script, and then discards the script and goes, but is much, much more confident for having done that in their presentation. Now, you all have other jobs, so I recognize that this is the kind of thing that you may have to make an evaluation of, how much time do I have to dedicate to this, and how useful is that to me in preparing a presentation. But if you're the kind of person who benefits from writing a script and you know that about yourself, then write yourself a script. That does not mean that everybody has to do that. The second part is practice. You should decide if you need to time yourself. Like I said when we started this, I'm going to make sure that you are out of here on time or early, because everybody prefers on time or early. Nobody, no matter how interesting your presentation is, says, boy, that was great, I wish I could have stayed in that room for another 15 minutes or another 30 minutes or what have you. So decide if you need to time yourself to make sure that you can hit those benchmarks. The more presentations you give, I'll say, the more confident you become in knowing, okay, I have 20 minutes worth here, I have an hour's worth here, I have 3 hours worth here, whatever it is. But you want to make sure that you know that you can fit in the time allotted. Everybody hates, absolutely hates staying overtime, even if it's interesting. And then also brainstorm possible questions. And the key thing here that I have as a secondary bullet point is, don't focus only on the smart questions. It is important to focus on the smart questions and what are the difficult questions that somebody might ask me and what are the questions that I don't want somebody to ask and how can I address those. But it's also important to think about, how might people not get it? And these are the questions that are usually the hardest to answer, because you give a talk and, you know, maybe you get a hard question but you're prepared for it. And then you get something just completely out of left field. And the more you can brainstorm what kind of ways people won't get it, the easier it is for you to address this kind of situation. So I often, for instance, if I'm giving a talk on diversity and inclusion material, I will pick some friends who I haven't talked about this with, and I will give them some modified version of the talk, so I'm not spending the whole day. And then I'll let them ask questions, and their questions are often just completely off the wall, and it helps me understand where I need to tighten up the presentation and what ways people might go astray. So all of this is obviously contingent on how much time you have. If you don't have a lot of time to prepare, then you have to make some decisions about what elements of preparation are going to be most important for you. Writing a script and practicing it, rehearsing it and delivering that to other people may go out the window. But all of these are, general best practices that you should do if you have the time and the wherewithal to do. I'm not going to be here, telling you that you've gone horribly astray if you don't do all of these things. But they're things to think about as you're planning your preparation. And now we get into the good stuff. So the platform skills are how you actually deliver your presentation in the room. Were there any questions on prior preparation before we go into platform skills? I'll pause here for a second.
We did have one question going back a little bit about suggestions for how to hold or handle a hand microphone.
Excellent. That actually builds into body posture, stance, and movement, but I will answer that right here. The physicality of giving a presentation is often challenging. And it's challenging because presentations are not a normal way of interacting with people. So it's not quite storytelling. It's not quite a conversation. You start to fixate on weird things like how I'm standing, how I'm moving, what am I doing with my hands. And I'll tell you, that doesn't really ever go away, but you can remind yourself what the best practices are and then give the appearance of confidence. So I was giving a co-presentation on Friday about research that we did on court reporter transcription of different accents. And my colleague was presenting, and I was standing beside the lectern, in front of everybody, totally naked. Like naked, you know, in the sense of like emotionally, not obviously naked. Not like, you know, imagine the audience is in their underwear. But just standing there with nothing, you know, blocking me, nothing in my hands, nothing to say as I'm listening to this person talk, but I'm also giving this presentation. And I remember thinking, what should I do with my hands? And then I remember, oh, wait, I teach people about this. I'm going to teach people about this this coming week. And the answer is actually surprisingly simple. You don't have to do anything. So I literally stood there with my hands by my side, not in my pockets, not behind me, not moving them or twiddling my fingers or whatever, just hands down. And you're kind of aware of it. But at the same time, for the rest of the audience, they think you're just a normal person standing normally. Right? So it's sort of, we get inside our own heads sometimes around this. With a handheld microphone, what I'll say is I usually hold it in my right hand because I'm right-handed, and then I'll gesture sometimes with the left hand. I'll talk more about gestures in just a minute. But you want to hold it a good distance away where people can still hear you. So just once you find the right distance, you're good. And it may feel weird to just be holding that handheld microphone in front of you, you know, with your arm up in front of you like a little T-Rex arm for however long your presentation is. But I guarantee you nobody's thinking about it at all. And if you watch like stand-up comedians, for instance, you see what they do with microphones, you realize it's not, there's not much to it. So the key with microphones and with your hands is just not to overthink it. With a lavalier or a lapel mic, I'll say that you want to test that out beforehand. And that can get a little interesting because if you start to move around a lot, you may hear, you know, noise from the microphone as you're rubbing on your lapel or something like that. So you should be aware of that. But normally, if someplace has a lavalier mic, they also have somebody whose job it is to make sure that the lavalier mic is actually working right and sounds good and all of that. There'll be somebody running up to you to, like, change out battery packs and whatever else. Run it through the back of your jacket or something like that. You usually have help with those kind of things. The handheld mic, it's just whatever works for you. And honestly, you know, I've experimented with different ways of holding the microphone. I like to hold sort of the bulb of the microphone if it's one of those classic, you know, metal bulb, you know, long sort of tube microphones. Other people hold the bottom of the sort of handle on it. It really doesn't matter. And I think people don't generally notice or give much thought to how you're holding the microphone. So you should be good there. It's just a question of whether they can hear you. So I'll ask you, later on, if you still have questions about that, please ask them. But that is a perfect segue into these platform skills. So effective speakers are going to manage nerves, voice, eye contact, body, and I have three more on the next slide as well. Nerves are key here. There's a fascinating book that I highly recommend called How Emotions Are Made. And the main takeaway that's relevant here is that there's not one physical signature in the brain and in the body for different emotions. Meaning, you can't put somebody in an MRI and scan their brain and say, ah, they're angry, or ah, they're sad, or whatever else. Different parts of the brain light up for a bunch of different emotions. So you can't really differentiate them. And the same goes for your body. And what that means is that nervousness and worry and, you know, things that as you start to get inside your own head before a presentation can start to spiral into, like, you know, panic and abject terror. These are things that are the same physical, like biological physical signatures as excitement. The kind of things that people feel when they, you know, if you like roller coasters and you're in line for one and you're looking forward to going on the roller coaster, it's the same kind of thing. And so one of the things that people say a lot is you should try and transform your nervous energy into positive energy. But they don't really tell you the tools to do that. The key for me is remembering that, you know, what you're feeling before a talk can be interpreted in a number of different ways. And so if you tell yourself this is terror, it may well become that. But if you can remind yourself, oh, this is a normal physical response to, you know, I'm going to be doing something different, which is really what it is. You know, when you have this worry before a presentation, is you know you're going to do something different in a minute. You don't know exactly how it's going to go, and it's sort of incoming, right? That could be anything. But for presentations, we get really psyched out about that. If you can remind yourself, you know, this is nerves, and this can just as easily be the feeling of excitement. That goes a long way towards calming your nerves, because if you can, and it's weird, it's just thinking about this, you can sort of reframe it into, like, I'm really excited to give this talk. Now, I'm not saying that'll always work for you, but I have found that to be immensely helpful in the past and you know, helpful to me today. The other thing that I'll say is nerves never really go away. So I, you know, make a living talking professionally. I make a living talking on the radio, talking, giving webinars like this, talking in front of rooms of people. And it doesn't matter who the room is. I get just as nervous talking to a room full of undergraduate students on material that is my research, where I'm the world's expert on this. I get just as nervous talking to a room of undergrads as I do talking to, you know, naval captains at the Naval Postgraduate School. So it's a normal response. It's not going to go away. But if you can recognize it for what it is, which is a normal, natural, physiological response that can also be interpreted as excitement, it goes a long way towards sort of calming your nerves and helping you with presentations in the future. The next point that I want to talk about is voice. So that's volume, pace, and intonation. And for those of you who were paying attention about an hour ago, you'll know this is what the research talks a lot about. So the key takeaway from all that research and from talking, you know, for decades is somebody's in some wind and unmuted. So the key point here is volume. You want to make sure that you can be heard. Pace and intonation. And intonation gets people really hung up. Pace is just how quickly you speak, and what I will say is that it becomes very easy to speed up as you get excited. Or, for instance, one of my colleagues has a habit of speeding up when she believes that what she's saying is sort of background material necessary to get to the point. So it'll be like, you know, she really speeds up, she's getting background material in order to get to the point. You lose people that way. So that is one thing. Again, I'll say, think of Maya Angelou and how she savors every word, and try and slow down. Until you start getting criticisms that you spoke way too slowly, you can just always slow down. And then the last part is intonation. People are judged on their intonation, I think wrongly, but it's something to be aware of. So for instance, there's what linguists refer to as high rising terminal and what lay people refer to as uptalk. This is something that is a natural, normal way of speaking for a variety of different speech communities that serves a particular communicative function. It's also something that young women in particular are negatively judged for. And so it's something to be aware of as you're thinking about intonation. And this varies from group to group. So what I'll say is, you know, cross-linguistically this varies, and it's something to keep in mind. For instance, question intonation in Russian is different than question intonation in English. And this is the kind of thing, if we don't think about it, it can create conflict or engender ill will. But even, you know, less than that, it's worth thinking about as you give presentations, especially for those of you who are listening to this who are women. It is unfortunate that in this day and age and in this country, it just happens to be the case that people will judge you more for your intonation. And that goes for uptalk or high-rising terminal, and that goes for creaky phonation or what people call vocal fry, which strangely men do just as much but are just not evaluated for. So that's something to keep in mind. And what I'll say is you can tailor it to your audience and you can give thought to how much you want to address that or not. The other part is there's little sort of verbal tics and quirks that we often develop and should be aware of. So I know a speaker who gave a talk where they said, right, after every point that they were trying to make. It's a normal conversational way of talking where you're soliciting feedback from your audience. But when you're giving a presentation, people start to interpret those things weirdly. So if you say and you know and sort of, these are natural ways of speaking that everybody does, but as you're giving a presentation, they become, one, somewhat distracting for people, and two, something that people start to judge. They start to evaluate your presentation based on your saying and you know and sort of and right. Whether or not they should, they do. And one quick tip that I'll give for people concerned about ums and uhs, which is most of us, is that you can just pause and not say anything. The function of an or an linguistically is to let the other people who you're in conversation with know that you're not done talking and that you're thinking of what to say next. When you're giving a presentation, the expectation is that you're not done talking because there's much more formal structure around that. And so what happens is people become very distracted by these ums and uhs because they're not going to interrupt you, or they shouldn't be going to interrupt you, we'll say. So as you're talking, it may take a little bit of practice, but I find it comes relatively quickly. You can scrub 90% of your ums and uhs by just remembering to pause and not say anything. And people will let you stop and formulate your thoughts and not interject if you do that. I'm not saying you get rid of all of them. It's, I think, impossible. But you'll notice that you have way fewer ums and uhs as you give a presentation. I'm sure there'll be questions about that afterwards, so I'll leave time for your questions about voice and accent and all of that. The last thing I'll say is that people are sometimes judged for their accents as well. Linguistic discrimination is sort of, there I'm saying sort of, is sort of the last domain of acceptable discrimination. And one of the ways that people do that is they talk about accents, they talk about high-rising terminal or uptalk, they talk about creaky voice. So if you have a strong regional accent, that may be something to be aware of. If you have, you know, verbal tics that are criticized by people, it may be something to be aware of. I am not, as a professional linguist and as a professional facilitator, I am not here telling you that you should have to change the way you speak at all. But what I will say is that as you are giving presentations to the public, it is worth thinking about what kind of persona you can adopt for your presentations that is more effective. If especially you think that you may be judged for how you speak along those parameters. You shouldn't be judged, but the reality is you may. And so if you know that about yourself, it may be worth thinking a little bit about how you give presentations and practicing in front of the mirror just to not say and ah, for instance. So moving on from that, eye contact is hugely important. And what I will say is, again, I was just at this linguistics conference, so I'm going to tell you about linguists. This is a joke that I heard first about engineers, so you can apply this to whoever this works for. But how do you tell the outgoing linguist at the conference? The answer is they're the one staring at your shoes instead of their own. So the point of that joke, and I'm assuming that you guys laughed, the point of that joke is really focusing on eye contact. In, especially in North American culture and Northern European cultures, there's an expectation of eye contact as a marker of confidence and trustworthiness. This is not the case everywhere, but it is generally the case here. And what I will say is when you have a room of 300 people, for instance, looking at you, you can't make eye contact in the same way that we normally think of when you're talking to somebody, you know, just in a small conversational setting. But what you can do is scan the room and be generally looking in the direction of people's faces, rather than looking at your notes, looking at your slides, looking at your shoes, looking at your thumbs, whatever it is, you know, that may feel easier to do that's less threatening. And I will say that I understand for a lot of people eye contact can feel threatening, and eye contact from 300 people can feel very threatening. But it's just a different thing. So you want to look out at your audience, scan across the room. Do not pick one person and just make eye contact with them, because that will creep them out and other people will notice and be creeped out. And it's going to be a whole weird thing. So try to make eye contact, but that's just scanning the room sort of gently across the room as you're looking at everybody's faces. The smaller the group, the easier it becomes, because if you have five people in a room, you can just go from person to person as you're talking and make sure that, you know, they're following along or whatever else. But you get a lot of feedback from people in a presentation as you're looking at their faces as well. So eye contact is important, but it can be a diffuse focus, and you want to just look, you know, at everyone in the room. So that's key. The last thing I want to say about that is, again, thinking about stand-up comedians, they're expert presenters. A lot of times, if you watch them, they look like they're looking at somebody in the room. But more often than not, with the spotlights and the house lights dimmed and everything, they can't see anybody. But they're looking like they're giving eye contact and they're engaging people. So that's relatively easy to do. You don't have to be making direct eye contact with specific people all the time, but just that kind of diffuse focus is very helpful. And it gives credibility to what you're saying, because you look like you're talking to people rather than not. The last one on this slide is body. That's posture, stance, and movement, and that is circling back to what we touched on a little bit before. So normally for a presentation, you would be standing. If you were standing, one of the things that people tend to do is, like I said, try to hide behind the lectern, or they'll try and move around. Or one of the things that a lot of people do is you get nervous and you start shifting your weight from one foot to the other, one foot to the other, and you end up swaying back and forth as you're talking like a little metronome in front of the room. And this is incredibly distracting for people. So I have a mental checklist that I do as I'm giving a presentation, which, like I said, I did on Friday when I was standing in front of the room and not talking, which is a little bit harder. And it was literally plant both feet, center my weight, thought about what am I doing with my hands. Well, okay, I don't have to do anything with my hands, so just let them hang, stand up straight, and just be there. Scan the room, look at my co-presenter. Scan the room, look at my co-presenter. And I actually got remarks afterwards about the confidence with which we gave our presentation. It was noticeable to people. And it's just, you know, this sort of basic stand and deliver. The name of the presentation, stand and deliver. So what I will say is the key point here is that it is very easy to do a variety of movements that are really self-soothing for us. You know, you twiddle your thumbs or you move your hands, you put your hand in your pocket and then realize your hand's in your pocket and take your hand out of your pocket and then put it in the other pocket and then cross your arms and uncross your arms and, you know, lean from side to side and sometimes pacing back and forth across the room. You individually will have whichever ones you may be most guilty of. And if you can remind yourself to just stand there, it can feel uncomfortable at first, but that discomfort goes away very quickly. And it gives a much better presentation because people aren't immediately distracted by what are all these weird quirks that this person has where they're pacing back and forth and they're wobbling and swaying and looking at their shoes and asking the audience questions rather than telling us things. And, you know, this all ties together. So if you can focus on just standing, it goes a long way towards having a very strong, effective presentation. I'm on to my next slide. These are the last three. It's gestures, language, and your transitions and segues. Gestures are building on that. You don't have to do anything with your hands. To the extent that you do, you should make your gestures meaningful. So if I'm using my hands, it will be, you know, for instance, I can say, I can demonstrate something like if something's a large thing versus a small thing, you use your hands for that demonstration. If you want to point at your slides, so you point at your slides. You can gesture towards your slides. If you're taking questions, depending on the audience, you can point at audience members, but I would say be careful with that, depending on who you're talking to, because directly pointing at people or pointing in one way or another can be interpreted differently for different audiences. I think you're all giving talks in the U.S., and so it should be fine. Although what I like to recommend is an open hand that's sort of vertical. So like pinky finger on the bottom, pointer finger on the top, all of your fingers straight, and you're gesturing towards whoever you're inviting a question from in a way that looks inviting, something between a handshake and a point with an open hand. That's something that I would strongly recommend rather than pointing with an index finger or, you know, hand up, hand down, any of that stuff. It's a very nice middle ground. But beyond that, you're going to make sure that your hand and facial gestures are in support of what you're saying. So that should be relatively easy if you're in your presentation. But sometimes people get caught up and they sort of betray very insecure feelings about what they're saying. And it may be that they're just insecure about giving a presentation to a lot of people, but it starts to look like you don't believe what you're saying. So the easy thing to do is just remind yourself, I don't really need to do much right now. You can keep your hands by your side. You can just hold the microphone, gesture when it's relevant. And you can't see me, but I'm actually gesturing at my slides right now. So, you know, it's not to say no gestures. But beyond that, try to keep it to a minimum. Moving on to language, it should be inclusive and technical. And that's a hard circle to square. So what I mean by that is that you want your language to be technical and accurate and correct. But especially for, you know, the EPA and especially for social scientists, it becomes very easy to use technical jargon without even realizing we're doing it. As I was preparing this, a colleague of mine said, oh, you can use an example, or I'll use an example of explaining social control in New York City. And the example that this person wanted to use, they said, I will talk about how I gave this talk to sociologists who weren't quantitative sociologists, and I talked about negative binomial distributions versus Poisson distributions, and I realized that that was too technical. And I had to step back and say, social control itself is a technical term in your field. And so that's what I mean. If you are going to be talking about anything technical, even if it's something that you use every day, I would recommend thinking about what are the terms that could confuse people. And then the easiest way to use technical terms while still being inclusive is to use it, define it, and use it again. So in the social control example, I would say, you know, this person was talking about social control, which is the sociological study of how people directly or indirectly enact control on other people's behaviors. And they were using social control to talk about blah, blah, blah. So what I did is I said the actual jargon, defined it, and then said it again in the sentence. I take an aside and tell you what it is that we're saying. And that's applicable across domains. So for the NARPM folks, that was very applicable for some of the details of, you know, toxic things that they had to explain to people. But it's also helpful, I make my Navy clients do this, because they'll walk into a room and introduce themselves and say something along the lines of, I'm so-and-so from thus and such, and I do NAVAIR SISCOM, but also SPAWAR SISCOM, and I'm T1 D30. And nobody knows what you're saying. You know, you're used to saying that stuff all the time. So I strongly recommend inclusive and technical language, where you just introduce a topic, anything that's technical jargon, anything you think might be technical jargon, anything you think could be confusing to somebody, define it at first use. And then when you use it again, it doesn't hurt to define it. Say, as you'll recall, that means this, and then you continue as you're talking. Lastly, transitions and segues. These are a roadmap for your audience. So you may have a very well-organized presentation because you did your prior presentation, your prior preparation, and you thought about presentations, and you got it all organized. If you don't have signposts for everybody else, it is still going to be confusing. You will lose people along the way. And so one of the things that I think is very helpful about this is it really helps organize a presentation and divide up the time, because you know you have to spend some amount of time on This is the objectives. This is the overall direction of the slideshow or the presentation. Now I am in section one where I will talk about this. I have just completed section one where I talked about this. What questions did you have? Now I'm moving on to section two, as you'll recall. Now I'm going to talk about this, and so on and so on. Clearly defining where you are in your presentation is going to really significantly help people's ability to follow and understand what it is you're saying. And a great example of this was when I first studied statistics in grad school, I took a class at the Wharton School, which is, you know, very famous for statistics and econometrics and all of that stuff. And the professor there, Professor Rosenbaum, organized every single class so that he had a two-hour class. The first half hour was a review of the previous class, and the last 15 minutes to half hour was a preview of the next class. So he had an hour of really, you know, meat on the bone of what he was talking about. And everything else was making sure that we understood how this fit into the bigger picture. You have a review, you have a preview. And that's hugely important. Now, some people thought that they were going to slide by, and they figured out that they could skip the first half hour of class because he was just going to review. They did not do well. It's the same thing with presentations like this. The way that I view it is my job to hold your hand and guide you through the presentation so you know where we are in the presentation, so you know we went over an introduction and our objectives. You know now that we're talking about one of the four categories of presentation skills for you to have. And even within the subdomain, you should know we're talking about, you know, body movement and all of that stuff. So you know where you are in the talk and where it's going and how this relates to everything else. And that's just really important to think about as you organize your talk. Let's see. So before I move on to soliciting questions, I'd like to ask what questions were there about the previous material? You'll notice we're in the point of the presentation where it starts to get very meta-aware because I've talked about enough aspects of presentations that you'll start to notice that I'm doing all of these things as we're talking. So what questions do you have?
All right, we've got a few queued up. If you want to go ahead and address those now. Let's start with this one. What pointers do you have if you are working from a script, like a presentation, for example, that might have been approved by attorneys where improvisation is?
Ah, that's an excellent question. Certain times you don't have the liberty to change organization. And so you have to work with what you have. And I have been in that situation before where you're given a script and it's you do this in this order. And at that point, you try and use as many of these best practices as you can, but you recognize that you are constrained by the organization and by the expectations that are put on you based on who's giving you the presentation. That's an excellent question. That's a very good point. So you can't necessarily always follow all of these tips. This is an ideal situation for you, and you have to adapt to the actual situation on the ground. And I know you all have a lot of lawyers that are going to be involved as well, so you have to make sure that you say things in a very specific way, then you just go with that. What else?
Do you have any rules of thumb for how long you should stay on one slide?
Some people have rules of thumb for this, and they vary wildly, and so I don't. I think that it's a question of how much time you need to spend on your topic. For me, I'd prefer to just talk as much as needed on a given topic and leave the same slide up. Other people prefer to break a topic up. So if I know that I'm going to be talking about body language for, let's say, 10 minutes, I may break that into three slides just to keep the pace feeling like it's moving. Personally, I think, especially with a back and forth with the audience, it's fine to just leave slides up. But different people have wildly different expectations. One of my former bosses insisted that you should spend 10 minutes on each slide, no fewer than 10 minutes on each slide. But that's because we're doing facilitations that are 3 hours at the shortest. For me, I'd rather sometimes build in more slides, build in fewer. I think it's really up to you. And I think if anybody tells you that you have to do it one way, if it's relevant to how you'll be evaluated, then maybe follow their advice. But otherwise, I think everybody has their own personal preferences, and we all tend to universalize those needlessly.
Thanks. We got another question. Do you have any thoughts about allowing questions during the presentation, for example, as you've been handling them today, or holding questions until the end of the presentation?
That boils down to two things. So one is your individual comfort level and your ability to refocus and get everybody back on track following the question. And the second is the format, really. So for instance, I gave a 20-minute conference talk recently, and the expectation in that format is you give a 20-minute talk and there's 10 minutes for questions. I had a, you know, tenured, I think actually a emeritus professor just shout out a question in the first 5 minutes. And that's, in that situation, somewhat taboo. It's a bit of a faux pas. That said, in this kind of situation where it's a 2-hour talk, you could easily do whichever one works for you. If I want to make sure that I get through all the material and I have concerns about time constraints, I will say, that's a great question, please ask me that at the end. Personally, I prefer having a conversation with people. So I prefer feedback. And, you know, if people ask you a question that's off the wall, or if they ask you a question that's inappropriate or whatever else, you can address that and keep it moving. Even with, you know, I'd love to talk with you at greater length about that later. But right now we need to focus on this. And we'll talk about participant management in just a minute as well. So you have this balance of what you're comfortable with. I'm not going to say that you should allow questions in your talk if you feel like it'll make you uncomfortable or derail your talk. But if you're comfortable with it, go for it. The world is yours. If there aren't any more right now that are pressing, I do want to continue with this material
sure.
And get to difficult participants. So I'm going to go to soliciting questions. What I would say is assume that there will be questions. You'll notice I've been trying my best to say, what questions do you have, and not say, are there any questions? You don't always succeed at this, but asking what questions do you have assumes that there are questions, and it validates people in asking those questions. Whereas if you say, are there any questions, there may be the implication or the assumption that maybe you shouldn't really have questions about this, and you know, perhaps you didn't follow if you have questions. So I always want to invite questions with, what questions do you have? Just assuming that there are questions, and then let people ask their questions, or not, as the case may be. When you ask for questions, this is huge, stop talking. Wait several moments for them to think. I tend to count to 10 in my head, and maybe there's no questions and you'll continue. But when you ask, are there any questions, the key thing that happens to most people is we get uncomfortable when we're the presenter, we're standing in front of a room, there's a bunch of people looking at you, and nobody's talking. And what I will say is you have to build that silence in to allow people time to think and to formulate their own questions. And so I give myself the activity of counting to 10 or to 20. You know, you wait until it is uncomfortable. And then you wait a little while longer. And then you can say, well, if questions come to you later, then please don't hesitate to ask. But if you are going to actually, in good faith, ask if people have questions or what questions they have, you have to leave extra time. And it's super uncomfortable. So I say, you know, recognize that going into it. Stop talking and wait. And I had this recently with someone I was co-facilitating with in Dahlgren, Virginia. And this person said, what questions do you have? Are there any questions? I don't see any hands going up. If there aren't any hands going up, then I'm going to continue moving on. But if you have any questions, ask your question. So do you have any questions? No questions? Okay, I'm going to continue. Didn't give anybody time to ask a question. And there actually were questions that people later said, oh, I wish I could have asked this at that point. It's something that happens to everybody. But if you can, really remember, just stop talking, and it's the ideal time to take a drink of water. It gives you something to do. You're standing in front of the room doing something, and it gives them time to actually think and ask questions. For answering the questions, you want to let the questioner finish. Don't assume you know where they're going. I think it's very easy often to assume that we know what somebody's asking and to want to head them off and then answer it. Along the same lines, rephrase the question. And I can't tell you how many times this has been incredibly helpful, because when you rephrase the question, you sometimes find that they were trying to ask something else. And so it helps to not just answer the question, not just assume that you know what they were asking, but to let them ask the question, rephrase it, and then answer it. And this is a standard practice in active listening. This goes for even, you know, having an argument with your spouse. This is also an excellent technique to use to bring that down a level, because you let somebody finish, rephrase and make sure that you understood, and then address what was asked. With a presentation, you should respond to everybody, not just the person who asked the question. And that's something that is very tempting to do, just stare at them and answer their question. But the question was for the benefit of everybody. People will want to know the answer, and you should bring everybody back in and include them in that. The other thing you should do is refer to the central theme of the speech or the presentation. So if they ask you a question that's completely off the wall, you can say, that was a great question. I'd love to address that with you after, but I really want to focus on X, where X is the topic of your presentation. And you can postpone an answer or throw it back to the group. So you can either say, great question, let's talk about that afterwards. You can say, what does everybody else feel about this question? What are your thoughts on this? So you have some flexibility there. Now, if it's a specific technical question where you know the answer and they don't, then you got to just answer the question. But it depends on what the question is. You can do that. And the last one is really remember to respect the questioner. Even if the question seems off the wall or maybe like a dumb question, just remember that adage, there are no stupid questions. It's worth respecting the person and trying to work with them to make sure that you understand, that you can rephrase, and that you can answer, or that they know that you respect them but will address it, whatever it is, later. Sometimes you can let the audience answer for you. Especially around the facilitation work that I do with, you know, diversity and inclusion, it's something where that kind of discussion can be very helpful and you guide it. For a lot of you, I think it's going to be direct questions where you just have to answer the question. That brings us to participant management, and I want to keep us moving forward because we have 16 minutes and I want to leave time for extra questions afterwards, and we're getting into sort of a nice closing point here. So effective speakers, the easy stuff is you use participants' names where possible, and you should reinforce the desired and appropriate participant behaviors. That's just the same thing of listening to the question, rephrasing, treating everybody with civility. Don't get heated, really. And then refer to the previous contributions made by participants. So one of the best ways that you can tie together a room is if somebody asks you a question, you can say, well, as so-and-so brought up earlier, yada, yada, yada. You'll also respond appropriately to questions. That means both in tone and content. And then manage challenging participant behavior to make the experience enjoyable for everybody. You may have challenging participants. So moving on to that slide. Contentious participants can be difficult, and it can become very easy to get thrown off balance or to get, we call it at Culture Point, we call it getting hooked. It's like hooked like a fish. You get dragged out of whatever it was you were in, and you find yourself just in a bad situation somewhere else. So don't get hooked is first. Attempt to take their question in the best, most charitable light. Even if you know that it wasn't intended as such, choose to reframe, choose to say, what's the best way that I can look at this question? Thank them for their question or for their feedback. If they are wrong, thank them for bringing up the topic and allowing you a chance to clarify. Rather than, no, you're wrong, and I already said this, what I'll do, and I've had to do this a few times recently, is I'll say, thank you for bringing that up. It's a very important topic, and I'm glad. I thank you for your question. It sounds like you're asking this. Is that correct? And then thank you for bringing that up. It allows me an opportunity to clarify this subject matter, which can be sometimes difficult. So X, Y, and Z, yada, 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 as you clarify. But thank them as for an opportunity to clarify rather than a direct challenge of, no, you're wrong. Don't get stuck Once you've done that, once you've clarified, you can cut it. You can say, you know, thank you for that. I'd like to move on and allow everybody else a chance to ask their questions. I will be around afterwards to continue this conversation, but let's cut this here. Because a lot of times it's very easy to get stuck in a back and forth with a contentious participant who really just wants to feel heard. You know, they have an oftentimes they disagree. They disagreed coming into it, and they just want you to know that they disagree. Well, they can achieve that pretty quickly, and you can cut it and move on. And if their comment's not relevant, you can thank them for participating and refocus. So thank you for that excellent insight. And are there further questions that people may have? So a lot of times I think the key point is to remember that you are in charge of the room. It is your presentation. And even when people try and take that away, the rest of the room understands the presentation format, and they want you, the presenter, to be in charge. Nobody likes it when some random person in the audience jumps up and starts, you know, asking challenging questions and whatever else. Nobody likes that. So they're very, very willing to go with you when you seize the reins again and say, thank you for that. Well, I'll address it later. You may have to say it firmly, but you should be good. A last point that we just kind of shoehorned in the end here, honestly, but I think it's a very important point, is that feedback is a gift. CulturePoint puts this in all of our presentations. I think it's hugely, hugely important. We talk about feedback as the gift of feedback. And at this point, we just talk about it as the gift. It is a gift. It is given to be helpful. When you give feedback, it should be specific rather than general. So not, I didn't like your presentation, but it should be, your presentation could have used work in this particular domain because you did X, Y, and Z, and it may be more helpful to do alpha, beta, gamma. It should be focused on behavior, not the person. So, again, if you're writing feedback of this presentation, I would hope for you did this thing that you could improve on and not, you know, Mr. Jones was dumb. I don't improve or get less dumb for being told that. It should be descriptive rather than evaluative. Again, that's, you know, it wasn't good versus it could be improved upon in these ways, or this was a challenge area, or this didn't work, or whatever. And it should be concise, well-timed, and checked. And by checked, I mean both tempered, as in, you know, don't get too caught up in I really hated it. And I also mean it should be verified, so you should be able to back up what you're saying about feedback. Now, the key is when you're receiving feedback, it is a gift. And this is something that we recommend that organizations solicit and that people solicit both vertically and horizontally in the organization and in both directions. So at CulturePoint, our bosses regularly solicit the gift of feedback. Sometimes you may not want to solicit it. Sometimes you may say, you know, it's like Christmas. I've gotten too many gifts. I'm going to take a break. We'll get the gift tomorrow. But, you know, in general, if you can provide feedback that is constructive and well-timed and behaviorally oriented and descriptive, that is an immense help to everyone. And if you can try and refocus or reframe whatever feedback that you get from people, even if it's not following these guidelines, if you can extract sort of the useful nugget of what it is they're trying to say, it's incredibly helpful. So I'm getting to the end here. I'm going to have a moment for questions, but I want to wrap up, and I have a couple of questions for you. What we did so far is discuss the objectives, which is to talk about the research on presentations and to talk about the tools that you can develop for giving presentations. And then we dove into all of this stand and deliver material, prior preparation, body language, visual aids, using the technology, all of that stuff. I've gone through and given you a lot of information, which hopefully is helpful to you all. And I recognize that you'll have to tailor this all to your particular needs when you're giving these presentations, but it should still be useful to you. You could use as much as you can. And now we're at the end where I'm going to wrap up, ask you what you've learned about presentations and about yourself and what you'll do differently. These are questions more for you, so you don't have to answer them to me if you have questions for me instead that are more pressing. But this is something to think about as you think about evaluating this presentation in particular. What have you learned and what can you do differently? Now, I want to say thank you. And I have another just under 10 minutes for whatever questions you may have now.
All right, we actually got a couple in the queue. We'll go ahead and start with those while folks are thinking about any remaining questions that they want to throw in there for our last few minutes. Okay.
You can't see me, but I just took a drink of water.
There you go. Perfect timing.
Following my own advice.
If you need notes and need to consult them during your presentation, is it distracting to move back to the podium to consult those notes, or should you try to stay behind the podium to avoid moving back and forth?
You know what? I don't think it's something really to worry about. If you have notes, sometimes people like flashcards, and they'll carry them around in their hands. If you have a handheld microphone, then you have an issue. Also, you know, if you have a lectern and the microphone is built in, then you got to stand right there. But as far as going back and forth to them, I've never heard negative things about going back to your notes. It's only if it interrupts the flow of your presentation. So you should know coming up, oh, I need to consult my notes for this next segment. And you should already be walking yourself in the room to where you need to be so you don't just stop talking and go, let me get my notes, and then walk to the lectern. But insofar as you can actually manage that, which is not too hard, it shouldn't be a problem. It's only distracting if it is done in a way where it becomes a distraction because you just sort of stopped in the middle of the presentation and now have to go look at your notes. That doesn't portray a lot of confidence or instill a lot of confidence. But looking at your notes on their own is not really a problem. Excellent question, by the way.
Great. Thank you. How do you feel about eye candy? Images that are related to the topic, but you don't speak to them directly. You know, something to just embellish your slides so that they're not all text bullets.
I did not use a lot here, but I actually love them, just so long as they're related somehow. And it can be a pretty abstract relationship. So you have plenty of, you know, Getty images or other non-copyrighted images that you can use that relate to what you're talking about. And it gives people a hook to remember what it is you were talking about and what it is you said. You should just make sure that they're not distracting, that they're not cluttered, and that they are actually related to what it is that you're saying, so that people don't walk away from that and 4 years later remember the cat presentation but not any of your content.
Excellent. And then our last one that we've got queued up at the moment we just did a couple more questions come in. One question on body language. Is it okay to move your hands occasionally but not constantly? Do you have any feedback on that?
I have a lot that I could say about that. My ethnic background is two different groups of people who gesture wildly and often. And for me, I've had to tone that down for professional presentations. I think that gestures in particular can be very helpful, but you want to hit a sweet spot between not moving at all and looking robotic, and between, way too much gesturing for your audience. And it depends on the audience. So if I'm giving a talk, you know, we give talks abroad. If I'm giving a talk in the south of France, I may ramp up my gesturing a little bit because I know that the audience will appreciate it. But in general, I will not tell you not to gesture because it's more or less impossible for me to do. But I will say that you should give some thought to who your audience is. And you'll know pretty quickly, if you're in the room with them, how they're reacting to gesturing. You can sort of accommodate it. It's the same as interacting with people outside of giving presentations. There's not really one right thing. I mean, one of the things that CulturePoint does is we talk a lot about cross-cultural communication, and that includes not just national and ethnic cultures, but also, you know, subcultures in the United States and in Canada and elsewhere. And so it's very rare that you'll get an answer from any of us at CulturePoint that says this is the one right way to do things. What we're rather going to tell you is think about who you're interacting with and who you're talking to and see if you can modulate it to that. You can't go wrong, though, with some targeted, specific gestures that relate to what you're saying. But beyond that, if you come from the same kind of background that I do, you may give some thought to which of those gestures are extraneous and just feel good for us as communicating like we would in a conversation versus a presentation. I hope that answers the question.
Great, thank you. And then we have one other question in the queue at the moment. Actually the person who just asked the question confirmed that that was a good answer.
Excellent.
We have one remaining question, and talking about the number of bullets on the slide, is it appropriate to have just one bullet on the slide, or should you aim to have at least two?
Well, if you were tracking my slides, you will see that I believe that one bullet is fine. But that, I think, is a matter of personal preference. I think if you are concerned that one bullet looks a little lonely, and you can organize your material in such a way as to prevent that, then it is absolutely fine to do that. The key is you don't want 19 bullets on the page, or you don't want 10 bullets and sub-bullets for each of those. So you'll want to divide it up in a way that you have a digestible amount of material on each slide and not more than a digestible amount of material. If it's just one bullet, I think that's fine because it's following that rule of being a digestible amount of material. If you feel uncomfortable with that, you know, make it two. You can find a way. It's sort of like cheating answers of like, do whatever you want. You can fool them somehow.
All right.
We're all just pretending to be professional until, sorry, you were saying.
Go ahead.
I was just going to finish with, we're all just pretending to be professional.
Yeah. And actually the one last question that we came in actually references our closing instructions and remarks. So Taylor, thank you very much for your presentation. Unless you had anything else, then I think we'll go ahead and transition over to our wrap-up instructions for the webinar.
I just want to say thank you, good luck, and happy presenting out there.
Wonderful, thank you. All right, so we will go ahead and transition over to our closing instructions. There are just a couple things that I want to touch on in the last couple minutes of our event. First of all, you should see a slide up right now that references some ways to stay informed about, in particular, about webinars that are going to be held in the future on the Fluent website. Most importantly, we have our monthly TechDirect email newsletter. That will always include a list of upcoming webinars for the next month. That are being offered through Cluin. We do also feature webinars that are sponsored by partner programs and other agencies that EPA works closely with. And then also, somebody just asked a question about the slide presentation. That is available on the seminar homepage. If you just click either webinar slides or related links, it's actually available under both of those tabs on the seminar homepage. So you can download a PDF copy of the slides used during today's presentation. And last but certainly not least, webinar certificates. So if you complete the feedback form, which is available through the seminar homepage, if you have that open in another browser tab, we also have it available over here on the right in the related URLs pod. You can go ahead and access the seminar feedback form. At the bottom of that form, there is your personal contact information is collected there, name, phone number, email address. And with that information, this little checkbox that I'm highlighting here, if you check that checkbox, then you will get a participation certificate immediately after submitting your feedback, that you can a PDF certificate that you can download, and then that will also be sent to you by email as well. So with that, I think we will go ahead and officially end today's seminar. Just as a reminder, we will be archiving this event, and you will be able to listen to the presentation as well as see everything that was presented in the Connect Room today. You will get an email notification within the next week letting you know when that archive is available for you to access. And once again, thank you, everyone, for joining us on today's session. We hope that you found it to be a valuable use of your time, and that we'll see you on a future webinar through Fluent. And with that, I will conclude today's broadcast. Thank you.